voted for the ref. He said, Peter, he said, don't ever forget that.
Boy, was he right.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the first of two February work sessions of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Under our schedule, we'll meet again in 2 weeks to take up the adoption of a six-year program. And the first item on the work session today, obviously, will be the presentation on that. Then tonight, I believe, beginning at 6 p.m., will be a public hearing, maybe well attended with BACO and VML and the General Assembly here in town. So we'll see about that turnout as well. This is a very, very difficult time of year with the Senate Transportation is meeting as we speak. We're here doing our budget, and one of the most significant issues or potential impacts are occurring in Washington, D.C. as we speak with the ongoing debate and amendments on the Senate side of the stimulus bill. Suffice it to say, we are going in a lot of different directions in transportation. The one thing that we do know is that the state revenue base is rapidly shrinking, and we have to bring revenues and expenditures into line. So that's our job over the next 2 weeks. And so the first item on the agenda is Ms. Buescher and Mr. Pitter to brief us on this latest and evolving draft of the six-year program. And I would say to those of the public who are here and the members of the CTB, it is very important that we keep this issue separate from the discussions of stimulus. And it may be an easy thing to say, that's something we can fix with stimulus, or if only we had stimulus, we wouldn't have this problem. The harsh reality is that whatever happens on Capitol Hill is likely to be a one-time solution. And what we are looking at here is at least for 6 years, but really charts a path for much longer. It is not a good path. I don't think any of us would advocate this path. But if you stand back and look at what Ms. Buescher and Mr. Pitter are about to present to us, we are maintaining our commitment to transit and rail. We are attempting to prevent further degradation of pavements, particularly on the primary and the interstate. And we are attempting to prevent further deterioration of our structurally deficient bridges. Those are not ambitious goals. And you note that we're not really talking about economic development or congestion relief and the things that we have spent historically a lot of time thinking about in this group. So welcome Ms. Buescher and Mr. Pitter to follow.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. It's wonderful to be here today. As the Secretary indicated, Mr. Pitter and I will present to you today what we're calling the Draft Revised Six-Year Improvement Program, fiscal year 2009 through 2014. And these changes are due to the significant revenue loss that is anticipated over the next 6 years. This is what we're also calling the second draft, we had a revised draft in December, but also at that time we received a notice of an additional revenue reduction, so we needed to accommodate that between December and today. The information that you will see today, however, combines the impacts from the December revised draft and this revised draft. So you'll see the comparisons between what you have in front of you back to the adopted fiscal year 09 through 14 program. The approved six-year improvement program that was adopted in June 2008 reflected the first revenue reduction that we were to experience over the next several months, and that was approximately $1.1 billion in state transportation revenue reductions. Now, when you combine that with the mid-year correction, we have at this point lost $2.6 billion in state and federal revenues, and that number we provided you back in December when we heard about the additional $400 million at that point. Now, what we'll be talking to you about today is that you will see transit reflect a slight programmatic increase, and because there's such a significant highway decrease, but also because of the increasing concentration and effort in public transportation, 33% of this revised program is transit and rail projects. Now, we will talk just a little bit about the maintenance transfer that has increased from the construction side of the house. That transfer has increased, but let me say that what that has done is allowed us to maintain a maintenance funding growth, but a reduced growth rate in our maintenance funding. So instead of the normal 4%, we're looking at 3%. And that would also be the same for our maintenance payments to localities. What we've done on the VDOT side is the same as what we've managed to be able to do on the locality side in terms of maintenance payments. And in a few minutes, you'll see where the highway construction program reductions of $2 billion from the ADOPT program in June, where that shows up in the different systems. One thing we've talked a little bit about over the past couple of meetings that does continue to play a role in this picture is, with reduced revenues, our ability to issue the $3 billion in a bonds that was authorized in House Bill 3202 has been reduced, and that was $3 billion. We're looking at the possibility of issuing $2.2 billion over the next 10 years. That is still subject to change as the economy goes on, but at this point in time, with this picture of our estimated revenues for the next 10 years, that's what it looks like will be available to us. Now, what we have also indicated to you is that because of that, what was anticipated in House Bill 3202 for these bonds, the purposes that was envisioned for these bonds to cover, we are not going to be able to realize the extent of the benefit. As you may remember, the bonds were to be used in an order of priority, and those are reflected in the slide. Transit and rail capital projects first, the federal match, revenue sharing, and then priority projects of statewide significance. And right now, we have $1.6 billion currently programmed. That's $100 million in the fiscal year 08 and $1.5 billion in 9-14 in the revised. And we have yet to sell $1 of bonds. So we are watching our situation carefully. We are trying to make sure we're matching all our federal dollars and sticking to our priorities, which we'll talk about it more as we go along. But we are trying to limit the increasing that amount, and because we don't look like we're going to be able to sell bonds until 2010. Our core priorities remain the same, in that maintenance and operating of the existing highway and transit systems is first, off the top. Next, we consistently want to match all available federal funds and meet federal mandates. We have priorities related to economic development. That remains a priority. Our efforts in that direction are limited at this time. We are still prioritizing transit and rail initiatives and congestion relief, and most definitely, bridge replacement and repair.
Take a question if you want.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
I should know probably, but you said that we probably would not be able to sell any bonds until 2010. Does that have to do with the revenue picture of Virginia, or the ability to sell them, or
the revenue projection or picture for Virginia
limits our ability to pay
the debt service on the bond?
That's what I want to be sure I understood. Thank you.
Dr. Davis just asked a very important question. Those who've been on the board for a while
remember that the insurance premium taxes that were supposed to offset the cost of the FRANS, which was the last $1 billion set of bond issues, the first call on that debt service is for the FRANS. If there's any left over, and with the revenue projections as late as last summer, there was some left over that would have allowed for additional bond issuance and to get us to about $3 billion over 10 years. But that revenue source has been shrinking such that I believe in this in the current fiscal year and next fiscal year for that matter, until late in next fiscal year, there's not enough excess to support an additional bond issuance. And so that's a very important point. And another thing that I sent around to you, the presentation I did to the legislative committees, and something we're going to be talking about after we get through this cleansing exercise, is in the judgment of many, I thank your chief financial officer for both DRPT and VDOT and myself, is that we are overly reliant on bond financing. And the long-term consequences of that are potentially significant. I would ask folks, please turn off your cell phones in the audience. This is very important. So this is a very, very important question, Dr. Davis, that you've asked, and I hope, again, we've got a budget-cutting exercise to get through, but that we think about, at the appropriate time, sustainability, because and if there are additional revenue cuts over and beyond this one, even this limited bonding capacity will be called into question.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I asked the question, too, is because I was a little confused as to whether or not it was because in the bond market itself you wouldn't be able to sell them reasonably, or the other side of it that I knew was positive is that the rates right now are fantastic if we could be in the bond market for the benefit of the Commonwealth. So there's three parts to that issue, and I don't think the public understands very well yet, unless we make it clear to them that the reason we can't do it is because we don't have the revenues to support the debt service.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Just to follow up on that, what has been the decrease in the expected revenue from the insurance premium?
I believe it's been about 8% recently.
While Ms. Buescher is getting that, your insurance premium taxes are basically based on the value of your home and your car as a percentage. Is a pretty good indicator of where they are headed. My recollection is they went from about $140 million a year down to about $120 million a year, somewhere in that range. I'm sure Rita will be able to get that information.
Sure. But at least for the next 24 months or 12, we can't look for any.
Correct. Yes, right now, looking at cash flow, looking at what we're involved in terms of program reductions, we really won't have the ability to accumulate enough resources until we could sell at the end of fiscal 10, and then in fiscal 11, we'd have enough to make the first debt payment on that sale. This slide is a total picture for both highway and rail and public transportation in terms of the revised six-year program, and we're showing you in a comparison format between the 2008 through 13 and the adopted 9 through 14. So as a combined reduction, we've gone from $10.6 billion to 8.9, and you can see approximately $2 billion in the highway construction section, and a slight increase in rail and public transportation related to Dulles. I'll talk specifically about the highway program, and when I'm finished, Mr. Pitter will come to the program and talk about DRPT. As we mentioned, or as I mentioned a few minutes ago, obviously our first priority at this point with limited state resources is to match and make maximum use of federal dollars. We had to, as we were revising this program, look at our strategy on how we would attempt to make the cuts that we needed to make. So first and foremost, we wanted to maximize federal funds now and going forward. That's why we also had to look at those projects that we had already obligated and those that we needed to obligate to meet the federal fiscal year 2009 federal strategy. Second, we really focused on trying to keep project phases that were underway funded, especially those where there were signed construction contracts in place. So we've managed to do that piece. We weren't able to keep all project phases underway going, but we have in terms of the construction phase. And again, we focused very carefully on safety projects, bridge projects, and the reconstruction of existing infrastructure as our priorities. Now, the breakdown of the $2 billion reduction by system and other categories is on this slide. You can see that interstate, primary, secondary, and urban was the bulk of the reduction at approximately $1.8 billion. Federal maintenance effort did go up, and that was where we were also focused on maintenance first. So you'll see a $200 million increase there in the federal funding of the maintenance program, because to keep that at somewhat of a level amount without state dollars, we had to use additional federal dollars.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Buescher, the secondary allocation is based on lane miles, is that right?
Population?
Mr. Bowie,
mainly population.
Secondary is based on urban is pure population. Secondary is non-federal land area population, and one other fact.
Just those.
I didn't get this material until yesterday. Didn't have a chance to research as I would like to, but I noticed that statewide secondaries were reduced 38%, and in our district they were reduced 52.8%. I was wondering why our district got hit so hard. Is that because of population or because of lane miles? Or?
Okay. I guess two things are going on, and I was going to talk about this a little bit further, but one of the things that occurred during this last revision is that state revenues were reduced to the point where we had no funding to go through the state construction formula. So the 40-30-30 distribution that had been there previously, we could not maintain in fiscal year 10 forward. So not only did we have prior cuts to all systems, in this last round, we actually could not afford to put funding. We ran out of dollars before we got to the 40-30-30 distribution. So primary, secondary, and urban took a second big hit in terms of funding. The next piece has to do with where money was on projects underway. So that was really the first phase of the cut. So what you're seeing now is the combination of the two, not being able to put money in the formula distribution for primary, secondary, and urban, and then where the money was on project phases underway. That we had to go project by project in the program to see where we could leave money and where we couldn't leave money. And one of the difficulties in the secondary system is a lot of that work is state and doesn't qualify for federal funding. So I couldn't substitute as much with discretionary dollars to replace what I had to eliminate as state dollars. So we've kind of gone through two rounds of hits. And unfortunately, primary, secondary, and urban took the largest hit. Secondary partly because funding may have been accumulating on a phase that wasn't underway. It was state allocation formula dollars, and I needed that money to put on other projects that was already underway. So it is truly a combination of things we've looked at. Every project, one by one, and we've looked at every phase on every project, and we've looked at previous dollars available. In the first rounds of cuts, we tried not to touch FY08 and prior money called previous, when we just focused on 9 to 14. In this last round, we couldn't do that. So we have literally tried to keep things funded every way possible. I know it doesn't look what you might want to say is equal by either a system or a locality or district, but it came down to what projects could be kept alive and what projects couldn't, what was underway and what was not underway.
Thank you.
That's a long answer. I apologize.
Mr. Boyle, if I might add to that, too, I think there are two ways of money that flows into the secondary system. One are the state funds that go through the statutory allocation. By and large, those state funds would be done on a proportionate basis across the state. The federal dollars are distributed by a different formula. They're not governed by the state statutory formula. And those are really allocated to broad regions for federal aid projects. And as Ms. Buescher was saying, we have to meet our contractual obligations. That's probably the two single biggest drivers in this are maintaining existing contracts and maintaining our federal obligation authority.
Unfortunately, this slide very clearly depicts the significant impact to the primary, secondary, and urban construction formula, the reductions or the lack of revenue that we were able to maintain in that process with this last revision. So what you see on this chart, this little red box in the revised 9 through 14, is just what we were able to leave in 09. And the elimination of or our inability to fund that formula in 10 through 14 is the reduction, which you see. So that small blip is just 9. You have, with your notebooks, lists that show specific project cuts by system. You have one list for interstate, secondary, urban, and primary, with specific projects and the amounts that were reduced for each. This just in some way for me summarized the magnitude of what we had to deal with and what you're facing. Even on the interstate, we've reduced funding on 41 projects, primary 89, and as Mr. Bowie indicated, secondary took a huge hit, and those are 549 projects received reduced funding. And in the urban area, 130, for a total of 809 projects that were impacted. One of the things that I mentioned earlier was core priorities and some of the focus that we had to decide to make with these significant reductions. And as you know, pavement condition is an issue, and I think you've received recently the pavement status report. We're responsible. I never know, not being an engineer, which way to approach this. There's 125,000 lane miles and about 58,000 miles. There's a distinction, so I'll let you all leave that. I'll leave that alone. I'll leave that to the engineers. But a total of 5,400 lane miles for interstate and about 22,000 for primaries. And the condition report for interstate indicated that in 2008, our condition dropped or went from 17.1% in 2006 to 20.5% in 2008. So it's going in the wrong direction. Our performance measurement is 18%. In terms of a deficiency. Primary is actually in a worse shape. The pavement condition went from 15.8% in 2006 to 24.4% in 2008. So it was critical that we maintain our funding of maintenance so that we can deal with asset investment in maintaining the highway that we currently have built. If at this point in time you wanted to fix the primary and interstate pavement condition and bring it to 18%, it would take about $1 billion today, one fell swoop.
That's with a B.
With a B. And a chart that staff has put together and that we've used in General Assembly presentations is this one that shows that these conditions are throughout the state. Various pockets, you can see more of the red than others, but it's significant. One of the other areas and something that is very near and dear to all of us is the deficient bridge structures. And the chief engineer tells me we have approximately 21,000 bridge structures statewide, of which 8.3% is structurally deficient. If we were today to try to eliminate those 1,700 structurally deficient bridges, it would cost approximately $3.7 billion. And unfortunately, in this revised program, we had to reduce funding on 97 bridge projects. And this next slide is extremely telling. This is the cumulative, the 1,700, almost 1,800 deficient bridges across the state. As the commissioner has spoken to you and will be speaking to you again in a couple weeks on his blueprint and the three legs of the stool with regard to dealing with our budget deficit or our reduction in revenues, just very quickly to summarize the other two legs of the stool besides the program reductions. We are looking at reducing staff at VDOT by 1,000. So currently we're at about 8,400, and we'd be coming down to about 7,500 in employee count. Not positions, but people. We're also in this effort looking to become more efficient and reduce our size in terms of facilities. So we'll be looking at consolidating numbers of facilities of different types. We're also, of course, looking at reducing general administration and overhead, both cost and staff. And as you are well aware, given the program reductions we've had to make, there will be an adjustment to engineering staffing to, I guess, match up with the size of the reduced program, if you will. We'll do our best to streamline business processes, and we're looking at technological advancements and efforts to help with the reduction in staff. And one of the things that we have done this year and made some inroads and accomplishments with is to maintain the effective emergency response that VDOT is known for. That wraps up my portion of today's presentation.
There are questions, Ms. Buescher, before we turn over to Mr.
Absolutely.
Peter and Ms. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Buescher, this states reduced staffing overall by 1,000, but I believe I heard you say 7,500.
We are going from about 8,500 down to 7,500, so we're reducing 1,000.
Reduced staffing overall by 1,000.
Right.
So this is addition to what's already been reduced? What am I hearing?
Ms. Carter, perhaps I can answer the question this way. We benchmarked our blueprint from last September, at which point our staffing level was at about 8,446 classified employees. So as we set the benchmarks for you in moving forward in the blueprint to achieve the organization and staffing leg, that would net out to the goal that was established of 7,500 across the department. And that's really what I'll be reporting. I reported the high-level overview to you last December, and now we'll be bringing forward the implementation both on the organization and staffing and on the service reductions that the Commonwealth can expect over the fiscal year 10.
Thank you. I understand now. I see the picture. However, it blows my mind to think that you can reduce that much and still have the services that you all are providing. And my hat goes off to you. And thank you, buddy. It's just amazing. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Busher.
Ms. Witt. Mine is not a question for Ms. Busher. It may be a follow-on. And I think in December or November I had said this, but as you present to us at a future meeting how these 1,000 reductions and the restructuring of the organization is going to occur, I'm going to remind you that I asked that you consider what if this is not the first step. What if next year is even worse? What does the organization look like if we have to cut another 1,000 on top of that? And suggest that as we're doing this planning, we not do this incrementally, but understand what an organization could look like if there's only 5,000 employees, and have that reflect on the decisions we're making today.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Witt, those are in fact the driving forces, as I reported in December when I've assembled the work that has been done by a variety of teams and the employee input. We have not taken a traditional organizational look at the department, but rather the core functions of our mission statement. So as I reported in December, our first priority is emergency response, maintenance, and operations. The second functional look will be at the construction, project development and construction inspection side of the department, restabilizing that in anticipation of a long-term recovery. And third, then, is our business practices and our structure for central office. So we've tried to account for your point. And this last week, I have now started a series of meetings in each of the districts and around the central office for groups to talk about the fundamentals of this as we get ready to talk about the impacts on people in the department. I appreciate the point of view.
To confirm a response to a question earlier, the insurance premium reductions are about 8.5% over the 6 years.
Right now. And there will be a revenue reforecast in mid-February. In fact, on the floor of the Senate today, there was discussion perhaps of delaying the state budget by a couple of weeks in order to take account of that latest schedule for revenue forecasts and to see what, if anything, will happen. There's a good bit of money being discussed in the so-called stimulus package in Washington. Far more at stake actually for Medicaid and unemployment insurances than for infrastructure and transportation in particular. Mr. Witt.
I'm going to follow on again. Ms. Busher, if, I seem like a doomsday person today, but if in fact these insurance revenues continue to go down so that 2010 is not the date that we can begin to issue bonds and it's pushed out another fiscal year or more. One, is that possible that if we have a continuing reduction in revenue, we may have to further delay the issuance of bonds? And then how does that affect our entire program going forward?
I'm looking at the Secretary. I don't know if he wants...
I'll give it a whirl if you don't want to try.
Save me.
This is the nuclear question.
We would have serious issues to resolve with regard to the fact that we have $1.6 billion programmed. And then that gets into the cash flow arena in terms of how much longer can we support normal expenditures on projects with bonds without the infusion of the bond proceeds. So we'd be looking at further delays and, hate to say it, but potentially not being able to match federal dollars.
And I would simply add, probably in a little more stark terms, even if they're substantially delayed beyond where they are, you get to the same net effect. And as I said at the outset, there are really three things going on in this program, which is keep bridges and pavements from deteriorating further, maintaining the current status on transit and rail and matching federal dollars. Without a viable bond program, we absolutely cannot maintain even the level of transit and rail that we have in place today, and we absolutely cannot match all of the federal funding streams that are necessary. So the domino effect, and remember, and we've talked about this openly in legislative committee, without adequate state funds to match federal dollars, for every $1 of state funds we don't have, we lose $4 of federal. So that is a very rapid cascade when and if we get to that point. Hopefully we don't get to that point.
Chairman,
Ms. King.
As a follow-up to that, though, in taking care of pavement and bridges, this report I heard $3.7 billion just to address structurally deficient bridges, an additional billion to address pavement or bring it to the 18% we use as a benchmark. We don't have that kind of money in this plan to address deficient bridges and pavement. So that's an urgent message. It's a red light message, I think, in the presentation to all of those that try to provide revenue for us to just do the maintenance on the infrastructure that we have. Another thing that we a request that might be good here is of those 1,700 bridges, when can we expect closure? You know, I think there's probably looking at a schedule of we're going to be closing some bridges out here, and that might be part of the message that needs to be part of the presentation we make. We're not going to be doing any construction, but now we're going to start closing bridges. We've already done that, but we're going to close more because they're going to be problems that we can't address.
I do think, and I know Commissioner probably wants to comment on this as well, bridges close in Virginia before they fall down. Absolutely, and we will never, ever compromise the public safety, and I do think it's important for the Commissioner to address that point as well.
Yeah, I'd like to address two points. To your point on the structures, that is why we have maintained and are fully funding our bridge inspection program as outlined, and that's about $16 million annually to inspect the 10,000 bridges. Can I predict for you, neither the chief engineer, I suspect, nor I, or the state bridge and structure engineer, will predict which bridges when, because we have such a range of age, use, and wear and tear on those structures. But that's why we've maintained that inspection program that we have as aggressively as we are. And your point is correct, however, that as we move forward, people can expect to see us making the hard decision when it is necessary, given that there's not funding to replace or do the major structural repairs that might be required. And you'll see that happen through the posting process. As our structures people start to say you need to post a bridge, that's an early hint. When you look at the age profile of our structures, that's a second major hint that tells you the structure is starting to get ready. We've lengthened the life of bridges, but a large, almost 54% of our bridges are built anticipating a 50-year lifespan in them, and so they're reaching that age. To the second point about the leverage of dollars for pavement condition and bridge repair, coming forward in the fiscal year 10 maintenance budget, you will see us make a shift in our philosophy, looking at our maintenance budget from a service perspective and from an asset investment perspective, not all lumped together. So for the first time, we will bring you an asset investment target to achieve those performance levels that we're talking about. We can't do it in a year. In fact, it will probably on the primaries be a four-year out target. And the remainder of the funding available to us will then drive our services program, which in fact turns around to the conversation we will have about what services can we afford. As I talked about prioritizing from the center line out to the edge of the right-of-way, that will significantly change our spending patterns in the services that we're currently providing the Commonwealth. We use funny examples or unique examples like mowing, like rest areas, those services that are not focused at the structure and the center line of the pavement. So you'll have full opportunity to see what those proposals look like, and they will need to be implemented beginning in fiscal year 10.
Any other questions or comments? Ms. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Business learns that the results that we're seeing on the table now are really the result of decisions that were made some time ago. So I have a couple of observations to make there. Number one, I remember when Governor Kaine proposed a comprehensive package to the legislature about this time in 2006. You had a strong hand in what that package contained, Mr. Chairman. But it did attack each one of these problems in turn, and I think it's clear now to us all we've missed an opportunity over the last 3 years in particular, good times, boom times, and now challenging times, to really tackle these challenges straight up, not tackle them through what we think our philosophy of taxation is and our philosophy of budgets and our philosophy of government service, but basically nuts and bolts, asphalt, bridges, you know, these are tangible assets. These are tangible things that we can either improve or not. But I think what it's led us to, and I'm struck by two things, is while there's some overlap, perhaps substantial overlap, between the priorities that are reflected and survive in our documents, I would have to say those are probably not the priorities we would choose now if we were to try to apply this diminishing set of revenues. And I applaud our colleague, Mr. Witt, and the commissioner for beginning to address that we've got to look further out faster, because this doesn't self-correct. And if government revenues in general lag economic recovery, we're looking at something even over the next 2 to 3 years that doesn't necessarily substantially improve. And we could be left implementing a set of priorities that used to make sense when our budget was this big and may not make sense when our budget's half that size or a third less or whatever that would be. I'd like for us to really think about that, and perhaps our larger discussion can reflect some of what we need to do, not in a pessimistic sense, but in a realistic sense. The second is I wasn't as concerned when there was a lot of revenue or adequate revenue that we were being led around a little by federal priorities. I do think it's a good policy that we always match those funds and get what we can, but what we're learning is their priorities aren't necessarily those we might set for our own communities and our own regions and our own state. We have to be careful, because we can end up building a lot of things because of somebody else's money that don't necessarily add up, and that we can't, in this case, perhaps maintain, provide the rolling stock, or make the additional pieces available ourselves. I'm worried, for example, in Fairfax County just now, as beautiful as that Hot Lanes project is on the Beltway, and it is tremendous. You can just see the work that's going on. The dirt's flying even. I don't know how they're digging dirt at 17 degrees myself. But the problem is all those new bridges, for example, that are widened and have bike lanes and pedestrian facilities will end on existing secondary roads that actually there's no money to continue a sidewalk. There's no money to continue the lane extension. There's no money to, in other words, carry the improvements forward so that you actually get the full effect of the network you're trying to create with, you know, robust choices for people to move around. So I'm really feeling a little hesitant here that our I don't think it's an incremental approach, but I do think we're in danger of sinking into that if we continue to think, let's wait another 6 months, let's wait and see what happens, let's hope somebody does something. It may be that we need to consider more draconian measures faster and then be pleasantly surprised if something better happens. That's just kind of some of my thoughts about this at the moment, Mr. Chairman.
Additional questions or comments? Ms. Connelly.
One of the major sources of revenue is the federal government, and I know we do want to match dollars, but hopefully, as Doug just said, not be led around totally by federal dollars. But what was the, knowing how in flux the federal trust highway trust fund is right now, what kind of basis did you project the federal revenues on?
I guess there were two levels. As we were trying to determine, and as the Federal Highway Trust Fund ran out of money, we were trying to figure out what that meant for us going forward. And then, as you know, there was an infusion of $8 billion to keep them afloat through, can't hear. So that concerned us very much, the fact that we were at the end of an authorization period. Normally, when we consider our federal revenue estimates, we look at the past years in the authorization. And this time, we weren't comfortable doing that based on the economy and the fact that not only were the gas tax revenue reductions impacting us at the state level, it was taking a huge toll at the federal level. So we determined that we would look at, and John, you'll have to help me, at, you want to come up? One thing we've done is we've set aside a reserve. And this was based on AASHTO's determination, and Jack Bassos, that, as you know, came to speak to us, that they were very concerned that, again, the federal government would run out of dollars before the end of this federal fiscal year and would need an infusion of cash, or maybe not. And then at what point would they deal in terms of 10 through 14 for us, or how they would handle the reauthorization and then the loss of revenue for significant revenue at the federal level, and maybe they wouldn't infuse enough to keep us whole or at prior year levels, but something less than that. So, John, we made one revenue reduction of about $200 million over 6 years, or $150 million, based on
The base revenue adjustment was the base revenue adjustment was adjusting the future years based on Air Virginia's projected fuel consumption growth. So what we've done is we took the last year of safety lieu, 2009, and then the growth from there out was based on air fuel consumption growth, which is almost nothing. So that's what she's referring to as it dropped to air federal revenue estimate by a little over $150 million over that period of time.
But you also have established it's a conservative revenue estimate, but then in addition to that, you have established a revenue reserve, correct?
We didn't reduce our revenue estimate to the level with which we have not programmed federal dollars. We reduced it approximately $150 million or $160 million over the 10 through 14. Based on the fuel consumption, but we've got an approximately $500 million reserve in federal dollars that we have not programmed at this point until we have a better idea of what our future looks like at the federal level.
So, to simplify a very, very complex set of calculations, if we were following the normal rules, we would have programmed an additional $500 million. Those are not. Those are set aside, in effect, in a revenue reserve. And we need to think about how to manage that. If we wait until the last minute to be sure that the revenues will be there, we won't be able to comply with all the federal rules in order to capture those. This is one of several issues between February 19th and June the 30th that we'll have to grapple with in terms of sustainability. But to your point, we have taken the most conservative revenue projection and then set aside approximately $500 million of federal revenues over 6 years, so with about $125 million a year, just in an abundance of caution. Some will say, well, that's great, I can put that on my project. Others will say, let's hold it out. I think we need to have that discussion, and you'll see, to Mr. Coulomb's point, item 4 on the agenda is to continue these discussions if we have time today. Okay, any other questions of Ms. Buescher or Mr. Lawson? Mr. McCarthy.
Well, maybe this will be better later on, but I really want to clarify from me what Mr. Coulomb was saying, because it sounded like he might be saying, and if he would please correct me, you know, maybe we ought to be looking at whether we should be spending over the next few years things that we committed to several years ago that are still in there. Is that what you were saying?
Mr. Chairman, in fact, I think that kind of review might be just as responsible as a blanket policy of honoring all the contracts that are being, that are already have been signed. And the circumstances, the point I was trying to make was the circumstances have changed significantly, not just incrementally. And I think Mr. Witt's accounting sense is telling him the same thing. Literally, where you are and where we are, businesses are just walking away from deposits on contracts and just saying, keep it. I'm not building. I'm not doing it. I'm not hiring. I'm not. I did those things in good faith, but you know that when the bottom drops out, I can't honor them. I have to just drop. Now, I'm not saying that we want to do that. The state's in a different position than a private business, and the federal government appears to be in a unique position that can never be approached by any other earthly entity. But I do think that it's very hard to do that, and it's probably a last step, but I think some of the circumstances have worsened beyond our best guess pretty quickly.
I would make one last point. One of the things I'd like to ask between now and the 19th is for Commissioner, you and your staff to go back and look at this program. You know, we call this a construction program, but when you pull it apart, I would be willing to bet most of the construction in here is just bridge replacement and pavement replacement. So this artificial distinction we have between, you know, maintenance and construction is one that increasingly makes less sense in this environment. I will say to Mr. Coulomb's point, though, if we're going to do a project, we ought to do it right. And whether it's a decision to locate an intermodal facility in Elliston, you know, to enter into a private partnership for the Beltway Hot Lanes, to do the Norfolk Light Rail project, there's a lot of additional money in there for that. So, you know, it's very important, I think, and I would agree, we may not want to be doing all the things that we have done in the past, but whatever we do, we still need to do it right, whether it's replacing a bridge or mitigating the impacts of a construction project or investing in rail. Okay, any other questions, comments?
I've got some comments, Mr. Chairman, but I'll save them for item 4.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Pittard, they're warmed up for you.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the board. I'm going to take you through the Department of Rail and Public Transportation's revised program. Start out just giving some highlights. And as unfortunate as today is, I do somewhat feel fortunate that we have been able to maintain the funding for transit and rail. It's a theme that Rita touched on, and fortunately that has happened at really the time it needed to. Ridership is up. I think y'all get a monthly report from us, and y'all seen year over year, every month, the ridership is up this year. The bonds were maintained for transit and rail in the program that you have before you. One real bright spot is we have programmed a demonstration service for passenger rail from both Lynchburg and Richmond to Washington, and that service will dovetail with BRE service to provide them more capacity also. Unfortunately, the revenue impacts have dampened our spirits too. We added a recordation tax 2 years ago in June, and at that time the estimated revenues were about $43 million a year. Today that number is about $23 million a year, obviously due to the condition of the housing market. And coupled that with our reduction in the Transportation Trust Fund, essentially the impact that we were looking for, which was to raise the state share of eligible expenditures that we were covering for operations of transit, we've essentially just been able to maintain where we were before. But once again, that's a positive in this economy, but not where we had hoped to be 2 years ago. The matching shares that you'll see for both our capital and operating program are down in the revised program. One difference from June to today is we do have allocations of our rail enhancement fund projects that we didn't have in June, but they are going to be included in this revision now that we've issued the rail resource allocation plan. And finally, I guess this is to reiterate, Rita touched on this, in the current program, which is the construction side of the VDOT side of the program and then our side of the program, rail transit currently, the program before you does represent about 33% of that program. This slide is just showing a six-year program from year 2008 to the revised of this year, and it does show a slight increase, as Ms. Busher touched on earlier. That's due to programming funds, federal matching funds from the bond program to match federal dollars earmarked to the WMATA, and also it includes some funding for Metrorail, which offsets our reductions to the revenues and the Transportation Trust Fund. The next slide, this is a familiar slide. In June, we were at 44%, so the impact to the recordation tax revenues were already being felt at that point from where they were June of 07. But we did drop in the revised program from 44% 6 months ago to a share of 40% today. And that's of eligible, we have a formula of eligible operating expenditures, so we're not providing 40% of the total operating, it's 40% of eligible expenditures, which in a nutshell, that starts out by getting taking federal funding away and farebox recovery funding away, and then certain items that we don't fund, particularly mechanics wages and bus drivers wages. And then what's left, this is our share of what we're contributing. One item to point out, so it's a slight drop. Without the recordation, we would be at 32%. And looking at the chart, that would be a historical low. So the recordation tax really did help maintain the level we had been at. Otherwise, we would be at a historical low for our matching share. Once again, just we didn't quite get the intended effect that we had hoped for from 2 years ago, but things are drastically different today. We do show a slight overall increase to our operating assistance of $12 million. $5 million of this is funds that were unused grant funds from prior years, and also we took an administrative cut of about $1.5 million, about 15% of our budget, and rolled it back in to mitigate the effect on our transit operators. And as I pointed out, ridership year-to-date is up 7%. And I guess one point I want to make here, too, is, and some of the discussion earlier touched on this a little bit, is federal revenues they're uncertain, and obviously they're driven a lot with gas tax. So an uncertain time for federal revenues, also local revenues, and then there's state revenues. That's typically how transit operators are being funded outside of the fare box. And although we've been able to maintain our level, our operators, when they're adding service and when they need to be at the top of their game, when they got new riders coming on board, they are going to be facing a significant difficulty in the 2010 timeframe with federal revenues potentially going down and then local revenues most likely going down. Next is the capital funding. This is down from 66% in the June adopted program to 64%. Primarily a very little effect here because of the majority of the funding is the capital bonds funding, which was maintained. $60 million out of approximately $85 million of this funding stream is bonds. So the impact from the Transportation Trust Fund revenue reductions did not have a large impact here. This slide gives a snapshot of some selected providers and the actual dollars of grants that they received in 2008 in the approved plan from June and the revised plan before you today. And as you can see, most everybody at least maintained the bottom, Charlottesville and Blacksburg. The differential there is the capital grant applications for fiscal year 2008. They had one-time capital applications such as a facility or a large bus purchase that they didn't have in 2009. So that's why that looks like a drop, but not really when apples to apples are compared. Next, I want to just touch on the rail programs. Y'all have had presentations on the six-year program, and the rail resource allocation plan has been presented to you. The program does include $212 million for eight projects that address both passenger and freight needs. And really, this is sort of the culmination, I would say, from back in 2005 when the Rail Enhancement Fund was dedicated. So now we've kind of done, since that time, we've done the first statewide look at a statewide plan, and now we've really got a six-year program for the first time of those revenues. Included in there, as I mentioned earlier, is the demonstration service and the related capital improvements in the 29 and I-95 corridors. Both for Norfolk Southern and CSX, there's freight initiatives, the Heartland Corridor Initiative, which comes out of the Port of Virginia through the mountains of Virginia to on to Ohio. It allows double stacking of freight containers. The National Gateway Initiative is CSX's version of the double stack for freight, which runs north-south along the I-95 corridor. Additionally, there's funding for intercity passenger rail, some port-related rail projects, VRE commuter rail projects, and high-speed rail initiatives that are in planning phases at this time. And just to touch a little bit more on the demonstration service, it's for 3 years. It's Lynchburg to Washington and Richmond to Washington. And the operational subsidy is estimated at $17.2 million, which is coming from unutilized grant funds. And then finally, the last item here is the rail preservation program has been unchanged in the current revision.
Is the rail preservation program mandated by the federal or by state, or what was the origin of that program?
The Rail Enhancement Fund, if I might, Mr. Pittard, was a legislative initiative of Governor Warner in 2005, and it dedicates a portion of the state, I believe it's a 3% tax on rental cars, to that fund. That's the basic funding source for it. So it's a recurrent dedicated funding source. It is very, very carefully separated from federal rail funds because the federal rules are very different, and they
require, for example, a title and ownership of assets as opposed to buying a service or a public benefit, which is the way our program is structured. It is widely regarded in rail circles as the most cutting-edge rail program in the country that does both freight and passenger rail.
Thank you.
And it is capital only, by the way.
And I'll just add to that. The Rail Enhancement Fund and the Rail Preservation Fund are both set out in the Code of Virginia as two distinct programs. The next slide basically is just a graphical picture of the project, some of the major projects. We have two transit projects, the Dulles Metro Rail project, which maybe it's hard to see on here. There's a small yellow line up there near Northern Virginia, the extension to the Dulles Airport, and the Norfolk Light Rail project that was spoken about earlier by the chairman, which is down in the Norfolk area. It's a purple line. And we have the Heartland Corridor initiative that I spoke on, and then the inner city passenger rail from Richmond and Lynchburg going to Washington. And finally, I just wanted to touch on the administrative aspects of our agency. We did go through an exercise to look at our spending, and we came up with a 15% reduction. Those initiatives that were scaled back, you know, I know the last 2 years we've come here with a lot of new initiatives and a lot of items that we've been pushing forward with, and we've had to scale some of them back, and some of them are the statewide transit and TDM plans. What we were going to do, we're scaling back that initiative significantly. Our performance review and compliance review programs, we're not going to end those programs, but we're scaling back the frequency of those programs. And then finally, the DRPT annual report, we're not doing at this time. So just a few things that we've had to cut back on. We had a reduction in the MEL from 40 to 42. That's our employment level. And as I mentioned earlier, the $5.1 million part of that was our administrative cuts, and part of it was unused grant funds that did serve to lessen the overall impact of this current reduction from 7.4 to 5.8%. And that's it for my presentation. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to field them.
Ms. Perry, if you could go back to the map. I just think there's such doom and gloom in this presentation, but I think, you know, there's really several decades of work that are reflected and are actually happening as we speak. We fully expect in the Dulles project to begin. Pre-construction has already begun, but heavy construction in April. We are sharing 50-50 the non-federal cost on the Norfolk Light Rail project, which is a tremendous project. And we will have under new business an item that DRPT was able to bring to fruition, which is an agreement with Norfolk Southern. So that's, you know, one more important link in this process to provide passenger rail. We've got one other set of agreements to close out, and those are with VRE, hopefully within the month. The Richmond and CSX corridor, not too far behind. And the balance between passenger and freight, which is so, you know, very difficult to achieve, has been struck in a way that, you know, the port is going to come back with the economy, and that rail connection is the most important competitive advantage of any port on the East Coast. We are the only port that can accept the post-Panamax ships coming in. And so that, and hopefully we can do something similar with the CSX to get the north-south traffic. There are enormous and powerful investments in the economic future of every region of the Commonwealth, and something this board, I hope, takes a great deal of pride in, because your DRPT and VDOT, who's been very much a part of every one of those initiatives, have worked very hard to make that happen. So while there's a lot of darkness today, there is some positive news, and I think this map is one of the best illustrations of it. Okay, any other questions or comments for Mr. Pittard or Ms. Buescher? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda, as we talk about transportation going a lot of different directions, is an update on the stimulus proposals with Dr. Mary Lynn Tischer. While she's queuing that up, it's safe to say that the Senate version of this is changing as we speak, with additional amendments being debated emailed around the country. One of the amazing things about a bill of this magnitude is electronic. Makes it a global enterprise, trust me. And it's important to understand that the transportation component, this really did start out as a shovel-ready infrastructure project, is less than 5% of the total package at this point. But $30 billion for highways and another 10 to 12, depending upon the House or the Senate, for transit is very significant and roughly equivalent on a federal basis. They put about $50 billion a year into those categories of funding, so that's $40 to $42 million. They're looking at an additional year of federal funding for the stimulus package is one way to think of this. And Dr. Tischer is going to walk us through some of the pluses and minuses of both the House and the Senate packages.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'll provide an overview of the transportation elements of the two stimulus bills that are progressing through the U.S. Congress. There are several similarities between the two bills. One is the share can be up to 100% federal. Secondly, that this is supposed to be supplemental funding and not in place of state funding. There are many provisions for federal oversight, audits, and investigations. And at least with respect to the transportation elements in both of the bills, there is no earmarking. The House approved the bill on January 28th of this year, providing an overall funding level of about $820 billion, of which $46 billion would go to transportation, and of that, $30 billion to highways, $12 billion to transit, $1 billion for passenger rail, and approximately $3 billion for airports. The Senate, as the Secretary has indicated, is discussing this as we speak, and so the numbers that you have up here are far from being stable. We don't exactly know how they will fall out. You'll note that the overall bill is larger than the House bill, but at this point, the transportation component is not. It is actually a little smaller than the House bill. There were about 260 amendments that were filed.
But I just went back to the transportation. I noticed there's nothing for water ports. Is that because it's covered in an, because I thought port security and all this was part of it. Is that not true? Or
ports are part of several pieces of this legislation, and actually if I could wait and go through the different components of it, that would be helpful. There were about 260 amendments that were filed for the Senate bill, and the leadership still contends that they will have a bill out of the Senate by tomorrow, but we'll see. The House has an apportionment formula that would use the overall share of federal funding in 2008. The Senate, on the other hand, at this point, has a formula that would depend on the surface transportation program, which uses lane miles, vehicle miles traveled, and tax payments as their variables to apportion funds. Also, the House has a provision, and actually they both have a provision, what you have probably seen in the paper as a use it or lose it provision, and that is that if less than 50% of the funds are obligated in the House within 90 days, then the portion that is unobligated of that 50% will be redistributed to other states. The funds not obligated by August 1st of 2010 will be redistributed to other states as well, with one exception, and I'll get to that in a few minutes. In the Senate, they have the same threshold notion or the same use it or lose it, in that 50% of the funds have to be obligated within a certain amount of time. But in the Senate bill, at this point, it's 180 days rather than the 90 that is in the House. And the portion that is not obligated of that 50% would then be redistributed to other states. The Senate bill would transfer anything that's unobligated after a year to a different program rather than redistribution to the other states, to a program that's called Projects of National or Regional Impact. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes as well. I should also add that Virginia does pretty well the same in the apportionment formulas, whether it's using obligation authority or the Senate bill or the House bill. It's a little bit better in the Senate bill. The House also would require that 45% of the funds be apportioned like the surface transportation program, 10% to enhancements and the rest by population. And if less than 50% of the funds are not obligated after 75 days, then that portion would be returned to the state for use. The Senate would handle it by having 40% of the funds apportioned using the population component of the surface transportation program, and they would not, however, redistribute the funding after the 180 days as the House would. For the Senate, at least 5% of the funds must be used for activities that are eligible under CMAQ. There's also a very small competitive grant program. And here is where stormwater management, passenger and freight rail, and port infrastructure are also eligible under the Highway Fund. And that gets to your question, Ms. Conley. The House would provide priority to projects that are in economically distressed areas, and they define that as being areas that have 80% of the national average in per capita income. And as you can see on this map here, the areas that are in yellow or green are the areas that would be considered distressed according to the federal law. And then also those that are within 1% or have 1% or higher than the national unemployment rate. And here you see the areas that would be eligible under that criteria. Both bills contain...
Martin are liking this.
Mr. Chairman, I always speak for myself, but I saw a summary of what's in these bills just this afternoon before I came over here. And there's a lot of stuff in there that's got nothing to do with what we're trying to do here or even creating jobs for that matter. It's a sad commentary on the Congress. I'll just leave it at that. I hope they improve it by tomorrow.
Well, as we say, with legislation, it has a long way to go.
Let's hope so.
Both bills contain provisions for a passenger rail programs of $250 million in the Senate and $300 million in the House. The Senate additionally has a $2 billion high-speed rail corridor program, which the House does not. Both of the bills address Amtrak. The Senate for about $850 million, the House $800 million. The Senate has a proviso that no more than 50% can be used on the Northeast Corridor. And the House has a requirement that none of the funds can be used for subsidizing operating losses. Both of the bills address transit. The House bill has $12 billion for transit activities, about $7 billion for urbanized formula grants, $750 million for the rural area formula, $2 billion for fixed guideway modernization, and $2.5 billion for new starts. At this point, and I mention that because there are a number of amendments that do address increases in funding, particularly for transit, and so we may see some significant change in these numbers. But the Senate provides funding for urbanized area formula grants and the rural area grants, and then additionally for a transit program for growing states in high density, which exists today, and then $200 million for reducing energy or greenhouse gases. Fifty percent of the transit funding must be under obligation within 90 days, the rest within 2 years, and if not, it's redistributed. On the Senate side, it's 50% must be obligated within 180 days, and if not, it's redistributed. But the money that is remaining or not obligated after a year goes to that grant program for projects of national or regional impact. the Secretary has an opportunity to extend that date beyond a year, but they must he or she must notify the Appropriation Committees in order to do that. There is a little bit of money for There's a little bit of money for FAA infrastructure. The House has no provision for that. And they both have some provisions for grants and aids for airports, about $1 billion in the Senate and $3 billion in the House. And there is proviso here for $100 million in the Senate program for grants to qualified shipyards, and that must be obligated within 180 days. There is not one in the House. Then, in addition, there is this Projects of National or Regional Impact program that's identified in the Senate, and that's for competitive projects of national or regional significance, in essence, to be administered by the Secretary. At this point in time, it's about $5.5 billion, and the eligible projects include, essentially, highways, transit, passenger and freight rail, and port infrastructure. The distribution needs to be geographically fair as well as provide a balance between urban and rural allocations, and each grant should be between $20 million and $500 million, with a priority to projects that will be completed within 3 years of enactment. You've probably heard a lot about the Buy America provision that is both in the Senate and the House bill. The language in the Senate bill is a little stronger, but that is exactly the same language that exists currently. There are also a requirement for certifications. In the Senate, it would require the governor or the mayor or other appropriate executive to certify that the investment has been fully vetted and also that it is in appropriate use of taxpayer dollars. The House side has a requirement that the governor has to certify that the state will maintain its effort with regard to state funding, and the governor is to submit a statement identifying the amount of funds that the state planned to expend as of October 1st, 2008. There also is a serious reporting requirement on the House side. Every 30 days, we need to report on the number of projects that went out, how much money we're spending, the amount of work that's completed, the number of jobs created or sustained, and their pay levels. That pretty much sums it up, and I would certainly be glad to provide any additional comments or respond to any questions if there are any.
Okay. I know Mr. White has a question. One thing, that we have said the first priority, should there be stimulus funds, and we never count things until they are fully passed and signed into law, but should these funds become available, the first priority, obviously where we are, would be for deficient pavements and deficient bridges. That's our first responsibility on the highway side, and very similarly on the transit and rail side. If we have failing rail sections, aging rail cars, that would be the first priority. So, Mr. White.
That was a great summary. I don't know how you did it with that, with what's going on in the Senate. But I've got questions in two areas. One, I think you mentioned going back to your page two, if you can go back to that.
Yep. Maybe.
You may be asking the
impossible.
He's there. That's great. I think you mentioned that the similarities were such that it was up to 100% of the federal share. So I take that to mean there are circumstances in the two bills where the state would have to put up a share. The other question relates to the fact that it's supplemental funding, and it has to be supplemental funding. And how does that fit with the Secretary's comments on pavement maintenance, bridge maintenance, and items that are already in our six-year plan?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. White, the up to 100% is at the discretion of the state or the MPO. So we could request less than that if we wanted to, but we do not need to. We could have 100% federal share. With respect to the requirement for, let me go zipping through that, the requirement of it being supplemental, that really gets at this this issue of certification, particularly in the House bill. In the Senate bill, it's just a requirement that whoever is the chief executive says that it's an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars, which is probably an easier statement to sign. The House, however, would require that the state must maintain existing, or not existing, I'm sorry, must maintain the level of effort that the state identified on October 1st of 2008. Needless to say, we're working on that language to the hope that will be changed before it be in conference, if not before.
If we were able to make the action currently scheduled for February the 19th retroactive to October, we might be able to. That, you know, there are, I shouldn't say this, there is a concern that there may be states who are trying to game the system and supplant existing projects with stimulus funds and then use that for non-transportation purposes. That is the intent, which is a legitimate goal of Congress, but how you write a maintenance of effort clause at that level of government is very challenging. But if this current maintenance of effort clause is in the final legislation, we will not be eligible for any stimulus money.
Chairman, how will this money be disbursed? Will it be, for example, our transportation money? Will it be coming through VDOT, the Transportation Board? Will it be going through the governor? Or hopefully not through the General Assembly?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bowie, it would occur the same way it does now.
Beg pardon?
The same way it does now, goes through DRPT or VDOT, depending upon the agency, and you have the authority to decide which projects would be employed.
Mr. Chairman, a caveat, unless the General Assembly decides otherwise. Mr. Davis.
I was listening carefully to what you said about the state being eligible, depending on the criteria that's there. If that requirement of sustaining the regular funding were there, then we could become very creative with things that are not in the six-year plan, I gather, if there were money available.
Theoretically, I suppose, but I wouldn't go there.
That's a hypothetical, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'm thinking.
Coming from an area in which you really couldn't say we're high unemployment or what was the other criteria?
Income, per capita income.
Yeah, per capita income, but still have some of the most horrendous transportation needs. What percentage, or is it all the projects are supposed to give priority to the unemployed areas with high unemployment or low per capita income?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Connolly, it only refers to the highway component of the stimulus bill.
Yeah.
However, the interpretation is open at this point in time. Congressman Oberstar says that as far as he's concerned, it's not meant to be a requirement, but it's just supposed to be a consideration. There seem to be others who suggest that in fact is not the case, that it's supposed to be a requirement. So it's unclear, I guess I would say, at this point in time, although, as I say also, Congressman Oberstar did not intend it to be.
With projects of national and regional impact, have those already been, the criteria already been established or used before? That's a brand new concept. So 81, for instance, or something, you'd have to make the case for it if that's part of it.
Yes, sir. Ms. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman, this may be too specific on slide 11. The number for new starts in the House, is that, can you tell me, is that a similar, you know, two-thirds more money in that program than is there now? Or, in other words, it's sort of the same level of additional funds?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coulomb, yes, this would be additional funding to what's in the New Start program at this point in time.
I'm trying to think of what's in the New Start program.
It's about the equivalent of 1 year appropriation.
So again, in keeping with this stimulus, is kind of doubling up federal transportation funding
for 1 year.
In 1 year. Okay. Any other questions, comments, concerns? Chip, did you want to add anything else, Commissioner?
Holding a breath.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Tischer.
Thank you.
Item number three is a legislative update. I don't see, is Mr. Donahue here? Can somebody cue the presentation up and maybe Rick Walton and I can kind of meander our way through this? And while we're trying to dance a little bit here, Mr. Donahue's over in Senate Transportation. There are a number of bills, some helpful, some not, and this is the last meeting of Senate Transportation. But Rick, maybe if you could please walk us through this, and we'll try and fill in. I know you and Nick work very closely on the overall legislative program.
Good afternoon. The infamous crossover weekend is coming up this weekend, and each House must have all their bills done and out by next Tuesday. So there'll be a lot of work this weekend. I'm sure that both courts committees will meet. But it's been an interesting session. At each of your chairs, you should have a handout where we've sort of gone through the bills of interest to transportation and have divided them into bills that the Secretary's office is taking the lead on that have interest to the Secretaries. Into bonds and bikes and pedestrians, so into various topics. So if you sort of want to look through there, that will give you an idea of the legislation that we are following. Everything's presentation today, I break it down into four areas: agency proposals, funding proposals, and PPTA proposals and other proposals. There were two VDOT pieces of legislation. The first one deals with system of state highways and what that bill will do, and that bill has been reported from House Transportation, and it will provide a mechanism where a road that is in the primary or the secondary system can be transferred to a local road system, so it would be able to be transferred to Henrico, Arlington, or to a city road system. Today the board only has the authority to transfer roads between the primary and the secondary system. So this adds another system. We do have some local governments, particularly in Northern Virginia. Arlington County's had a desire for a while on Columbia Pike, which is part of the primary system, to have that road added to its local road system. So that would accommodate that. At the same time, that bill also gives other counties the ability to do likewise, to take over their road system. And in our devolution today, while we've had a provision that allows the local government to take over the road system still remains the secondary system, whereas this bill would allow these counties to do exactly what Henrico and Arlington have done and basically create their own road system. And if they did so, they would receive the same payments that Arlington and Henrico receive today. The overweight permit was a result of a study that was conducted by the Research Council, DMV, and the industry. There was a lot of concern, particularly in the present economy, with charging overweight trucks for using our highways. There are a number of them today who travel for free. Because of that, it was recommended that all of the overweight bills be sent to the Joint Commission on Transportation Accountability to be studied this year. And several bills dealing with overweight sand and gravel trucks out in the coal severance areas of Southwest Virginia to maintain the status quo, all of those bills were extended for another year. So the sunset is now 2010. And that's happened for about the last 5 or 6 years every year. Delegate Jericho, Delegate Phillips, you know, others come in and move this. This year they wanted to get rid of the sunset completely, but it was felt, let's study this thing for a while, so it was extended for a year. Maybe Chip can speak more to the DRPT, although I looked at them a little bit before I came in, Under the WMATA Compact amendments, it increases from 6 to 8. The members of the board of WMATA and those two additional members are from the federal government, and one has to be a regular user of the bus or rail system in Northern Virginia. It also allows for the appointment of two non-voting alternates that are federal employees. It creates an inspector general's office, and it also provides for a dedicated funding source of state dollars to match the federal dollars for the metro system. There's also a bill on safety oversight, which again is to comply with federal requirements on having an agency that's in charge of federal oversight of rail. And then finally, the procurement bill basically gives the Department of Rail and Public Transportation the same ability that VDOT has to contract for on-call architectural and engineering services. Several general fund proposals dealing with setting aside a certain percentage of general fund revenues. Of the four that are listed there, three of them, HB 1579, which is Delegate Odor's bill, which identifies the various ports and uses a 30% of the revenue growth for transportation. That bill has been sent to appropriations. House Bill 2130, which sets aside 10% of annual growth in the general fund for highways, is also in appropriations. 2206 mandates that the governor include in his budget 10% of the general fund growth from the previous biennium. That's for transportation. That's also, actually, that was tabled by a subcommittee of appropriations. And then 2622 is the Salem Construction District Program, which is somewhat of a companion of 1579 and basically uses the intermodal facility as the port for which the growth there, that money would be used for constructing projects in the Salem District, and the two projects that are identified are I-81 and I-73. Again, that is an appropriations. I've already talked about the overweight permits. We have other proposals, motor fuel tax proposals, and then finally HB 1642, which would allow the CTB to name facilities for a living person or entity. Had some very interesting debate on the floor of the House today, and the bill, they refused to engross the bill by a vote of about 60 to 30, so that bill is now dead for the year.
Question, Mr. Chairman. Rick, what does that have to do with funding?
Well, they'd have to pay for it. The concept is the person or the entity would have to pay for it.
Right.
And, of course, they had a great time with that about different names they could make. It actually got down to that we'd have the Google symbol on the seal of the Commonwealth before it was all over with. So they decided to let that bill ride for the year. As far as PPTAs, every year we get a number of those. The first two, 2066 and 2079, came from delegates in the Hampton Roads area. Both of them tighten the time frame for our review and recommendation on PPTAs. 2079 deals specifically with the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel and putting out, it actually require us to solicit a proposal for the HRBT by September 30th of this year, and to make a recommendation on whether to move forward by March of next year. House Bill 2117, a bill that was also introduced last year, got a little legs this year, got a few more votes, and House Transportation still wasn't reported, would have prohibited the construction of a hot lanes project in Northern Virginia on the northern segment from the Springfield interchange. It would have actually required specific approval of the General Assembly, but that bill did not report. House Bill 2172 is actually an outgrowth of the Governor's Commission on Climate Change, and this would allow the use of the right-of-way for renewable energy sources, and that bill is making its way. We've been involved in that. There's been several drafts. I think it's going for a final review by the General Laws Committee this afternoon. And finally, Senate Bill 1232, which is being heard as I speak, and 6% of transportation would require specific monetary penalties to be included in our comprehensive agreement for the 395 hot lanes if the traffic does not maintain the posted speed limit for 90% of the time over a consecutive 180-day period. There's also a Senate joint resolution on the same point, but not quite as demanding of what we do in our contract, more of suggestive that it'd be nice to have that sort of language in our agreement. Other proposals, 1590 would be a 10% credit for what you paid in tolls. 1723, there are a number of allocation formula changes. As Delegate Albo said yesterday, there are winners and there are losers. And he actually had a list of all the winners and all the losers and all the big losers. And with every allocation change, there'll be winners and losers. HB 1993 and Senate Bill 1368, it should be of specific interest to the board. It allows the board, actually requires the board, when making allocation to maintenance, that it look at the assets and look at the performance measures of those assets and to allocate funding to close the disparity between certain assets. We saw it today in an earlier slide about our pavement condition. In some parts of the state, our pavement conditions are closer to that 18% level, and others they're worse, probably in all areas getting worse. But it would allow the board to allocate funds as to close that disparity. HB 2099, Ms. Carter, that is something that BAMPO had recommended, establishes the George Washington Toll Road Authority. And then we mentioned earlier HB 2172. HB 1835, not real sure about. That's DRPT bill. 1848 was Delegate Lingenfelter's bill that would require a performance audit of all transportation agencies. It had about a $4 million price tag. Initially, that was going to come out of the Transportation Trust Fund. It was changed in committee to come out of general fund, was sent to appropriations where it died. So that bill is dead for the year. 2158, the Charlottesville Albemarle Transit Authority, I'm assuming that just establishes a separate transit authority in that area. 2420 and 1475 deal with the intermodal office and the secretary and increasing its responsibilities. 1482 was Senator Hanger's bill, which would repeal the $3 billion in bond authorizations in House Bill 3202. And then finally, my favorite bill of the session, Senate Bill 1464, the Secretary, abolishes the Secretary of Transportation and creates a Chief Executive Officer for Transportation. And actually, the CTB would be in charge of aviation, rail, other ports. I think all the transportation modes would fall under the Chief Executive Officer and under the Transportation Board, would eliminate the Office of the Secretary.
Sure. To be appointed and elected by the General Assembly.
Who's facing that bill?
Senator McDougal.
Senator McDougal's bill. Budget amendments. One that's created a lot of controversy recently in Mr. White's neighborhood would prohibit the use of any state funds for the Lynchburg to D.C. passenger rail initiative unless the entire service was extended to Bristol. I understand that hopefully is being worked out. You can see several of the other ones, suspending an implementation of our Chapter 527 traffic impact analysis regulations until 2014. And then again, an attempt to prohibit construction of the Hot Lanes project without prior approval from the General Assembly. And with that, if you have any questions on any of the other bills that was handed out, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Ms. Wong, if you go back to the last slide, I just would like to make an editorial comment in the amount of energy that is being devoted to try and undo a priority. So passenger rail, a priority of the Commonwealth articulated in the budget for a number of years. Mass transit capital, that is going backwards on mass transit capital assistance, which
you know, sounds appealing in the short term, but creates long-term liabilities. That has been, again, a priority to the governor and this board. Traffic impact analysis. That is the basis for integrating transportation and land use in Virginia, one of the most important pieces of legislation, to go backwards on that. And the hot lanes, again, a priority of the governor, of this board, and the General Assembly through repeated actions. And, you know, one of the things I was talking to a colleague today who just, you know, I've been sitting through some of these discussions, and I said, boy, you look really bemused. And the discussion in the General Assembly is not the substance that we have become accustomed dealing with the last 3 years. Now, I would not characterize it as theatrics, but others might. And, you know, the sad thing is the amount of time that's being devoted to this. And so in the case of the Hampton Roads region, two legislators, Delegate Hamilton, Delegate Oder, you know, good friends, good legislators. But one has a bill that says, Mr. Walton talked about purporting to attribute general fund growth to the Port of Hampton Roads, and then it was Dulles Airport, then it was Elliston, then it was probably Charlottesville Hospital, a few other things, and saying that will be the basis for distributing transportation. And, you know, ignoring two basic facts. Virginia is a triple-A bond state because we do a six-year general fund revenue forecast as we do for here in transportation, and being unwilling to change that forecast. That would be the first step that you would need to do. And then ignoring the hard lessons of history most of us have dealt with when you try to put general funds into transportation, which are subject to annual appropriation, and they are here today and gone tomorrow. And I can point you to FRANS, the $1.1 billion in FRANS. Most of those debt is there because there was a general fund commitment that went away. And Governor Kaine had dedicated $500 million in one-time general funds transportation. Last session, with revenue downturn, took $185 million of that back and said, well, you can sell transportation bonds. And so, you know, this notion that somehow there's a way of capturing general fund revenues and making it work in transportation is simply wrong. And we have very recent history to demonstrate that. A similar legislation regarding the PPTA to single out maybe a worthy project or not, the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, to say VDOT shall accept proposals to widen the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel. That is circumventing the Public Procurement Act, it is circumventing the regional planning process, and it is making assumptions about what can and cannot work in the marketplace. And so, you know, we maybe have not done the job of educating our legislators that I thought we had. And it is such recent history. In the case of the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, we went down that road on I-81, and we made a mistake. I made a mistake. We put the PPTA cart in front of the planning horse. And so we're trying to, you know, repeat. If it were 10 years ago or 15 years ago, maybe it would be understandable. But this is all recent history. And again, one of the fascinating things about dealing. But I do think our work is cut out for us about educating the General Assembly just the mechanics of how the transportation business works. And I'm sorry to go on that, but I spent a lot of time in committee dealing with this type of legislation and, frankly, defending great projects. It's cool, mate.
Mr. Chairman, I was particularly intrigued when it was introduced in now SB 1464 that would basically alter the structure of our entire governance. It's a little bit unusual that a gentleman who represents Cole Harbor wouldn't have understood that a frontal assault on fortified lines probably isn't your best tactic in these things. But also, I think I have an explanation for what you mentioned in terms of ideas. There's, as you know, a new thing on the in the modern cultures to invent new words to explain phenomenon. And one of the new words this year is bosone. And that's the layer around someone's head that keeps facts and rational thought from either exiting or entering.
And what's the word? Bosone.
Bosone. It's the bosone layer. And I only say that half in jest because, quite frankly, the level of discussion on these topics over the last few years has been very discouraging. Not perhaps so much to require a change that SB 1464 might have, but we have to somehow raise the level of the discussion to get the facts in front of people and have them understand that things can't, I mean, you just can't make things work without resources. You can't make things work without commitment. You can't be episodic in these complex multi-year projects. And you have to understand the concept of a network, that it's not just a project, it's the connections that are made possible by a piece and how people use them and so forth. So I feel for you. I feel for you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Walton. We're doing on time. It's 5 o'clock. We're going to start the public hearing at 6. What I'll suggest is we take up the last item for about 30 minutes or so of open discussion, and we'll break. There will be, will that give us enough time to, there will be food set up in one of the outside rooms, and then we'll begin the public hearing right at 6. So what I'd like to do, we...
Chairman, a quick question. Was the public hearing advertised at 6 or 6:30?
I think it was advertised at 6:30,
okay.
At the end of the meeting, are that? Didn't it say what these are?
Well, whatever. We need to be time certain on a public hearing. And we also have the business agenda to take through. So what I might suggest is why don't we take up, just run through the business agenda very quickly, and then we'll come back and do item 4 to have some open-ended discussion, and folks can continue that, not as a group, but informally and one-on-one. Afterwards, if that's acceptable to all. Okay? Item 4 on the work session agenda, which is an open discussion about really the future of transportation, the relationship of the board, transportation and land use, the floor is open. And so I...
Mr. Chairman, you know, we talked about this a little bit at the last meeting, and I made some comments then about the six-year plan, and we really needed to think out of the box and think creatively on how we're going to deal with the new reality of the fact there is no money. And looking at it again today, my thoughts were just reinforced. I'm one who thinks now that we're never going to get back to the level of funding with the bang for the buck that we had before, with cost increases that we're facing in virtually every aspect of our program, and the fact that our dedicated sources of funding are declining and probably will continue to decline. Gasoline consumption as that goes down, and alternative sources of fuel as they come online, and the competing needs that the General Assembly is faced with and Congress is faced with, says all those things say to me that we're going to have to deal with a much smaller income stream. And as I look at our six-year plan, you know, I think it was mentioned earlier that there are things in there that are ready to go to construction that aren't necessarily the priorities that exist in 2009. Some of them were priorities maybe 20 years ago when they first went into the plan. And they went into the plan at a time when there was a lot of money on a comparative basis, and so those items could be added. And what's happened in the meantime is that as we have faced new priorities, we haven't had the resources to put those projects into the plan. So, you know, I don't know what the answer is, and I admitted that at the last meeting, but as the commissioner and his staff rethink the size of the agency moving forward beyond this $100,000 cut that we are faced with now. As they rethink the future role of the agency, I think I, as a board member, would appreciate out-of-the-box thinking and creative thinking from the staff as to how we can restructure an approach to the six-year plan. Now, I'm mindful that all politics are local. I understand that. And that if we start changing the allocation formulas, they're going to be winners and losers, as Rick Walton said earlier. But the fact is that we're not getting it done with the formulas that are currently in place. And we have a board that is looking, and I think has for quite some time, looked at transportation as a statewide network and a statewide problem, and not necessarily from the standpoint of each construction district of whether we get $1 million more for a project that may or may not fit into the priorities of the state. And I reiterate, I think we just, as a board and the department, need to really think creatively on how we're going to deal with this in the future. For example, the primary system, there are primary roads, I will admit, in my district that are getting money that perhaps don't deserve it compared to primary roads in other districts where there are more people and more traffic. I think we've already dealt with the maintenance issue that is the subject of one of the bills. I think we have a policy in place where we spend maintenance dollars where they're needed, not on necessarily a formula basis. It's if the wear and tear in the Richmond district is greater than in my district, I mean, that more money goes there to fix those roads. And I think we need to look at that creatively from a construction standpoint as well as looking at the size of the projects. I just don't believe that we're going to continue to be able to fund projects of the magnitude that we've done in the past. The Cadillac projects, we're going to have to look at Chevrolet projects. In 5 years, people may be saying, what's a Cadillac, what's a Chevrolet? I don't know, but we are not going to be able to continue to produce the kind of projects that we have in the past. I wish I had a solution to it. I wish I had a plan I could lay on the table, but I think that's one of the things that we need to look at moving forward as a board and as a department.
If I might interject two things. The first is that even though we have a needs-based maintenance allocation, one of the things the commissioner did, an amazing report, State of the Pavement, and another, has that been forwarded to the CTB yet? And State of the Bridges? Those are very, very important reports, and we don't have there are disparities in pavement conditions, and so one of the things that over I think we'll be able to begin doing based on that kind of great analysis is really sharpen the focus of the pavement program. With respect to the deficient bridges, it is not readily apparent because it is a small program, but virtually any money that was not necessary to, you know, meet a federal obligation went to a bridge that was on the chief engineer's deficiency list on a statewide basis. Those are two very important innovations in there. And again, one of the things I think if Rita and her staff can take a breather is to really stand back and look at the construction program and ask question how much, there's very little new capacity in there. And I hear what you're saying about small projects, but I look at the Midtown Tunnel, okay? That should have been a four-lane tunnel 50 years ago. It's the busiest two-lane road. And we got a proposal back on that at $2 billion, which is equivalent to the Wilson Bridge. And yet, that tunnel is over 50 years old, and they're just not a cheap solution. And the existing tunnel is not going to last forever. So, I mean, that is going to be the dilemma. A retrofit is always expensive, and one of the reasons that we've had sprawl, for example, is that it is easier to build a new facility further away rather than dealing with the hard conflicts of infrastructure closer in. And so that is absolutely a challenge. So, Mr. Witt.
Mr. Secretary, let me add on to what Mr. White has said and start by saying that bridges have been a concern of mine since I've been on this board. We received a report a year or so ago, and just doing a quick calculation as to our bridge replacement over the last 10 years, and just dividing that number into the number of bridges that we have reported in Virginia, it was going to take us 147 years, or 143 years or something, at that rate to replace Virginia's bridges. They are aging faster at this point than our future sources of revenue. Mr. White talked about looking at our entire state plan. I agree with you on the Midtown Tunnel. At least twice a week I have to go through that. But, you know, the first span of the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel is 50-some years old now. It is aging rapidly. And at some point, we're going to be talking about just maintenance, replacement-type maintenance of the major corridor through Hampton Roads. At the rate we're going, I'm not so sure we shouldn't be asking ourselves what happens with these 22,000 bridges and culverts in Virginia if over the next period of time we have to close 4,000 of them. What does that do to our highway system if in fact we're not going to be able to repair all those things? And back to what Mr. White said, which roads are most important, and how are we going to maintain a network that's not going to be the same network that it was? Populations have moved, priorities have changed, and we may not be able to support urban sprawl like we did. I ask those rhetorical questions because I think we are to the tipping point. I think we are to the point where we are not going to be able to maintain the system we have in Virginia. And I think it's incumbent upon this board to realize that and to say, if we're not going to have what we had in the past, what does the future look like 10 years from now? And how do we change the way we do business, change what our priorities are, change what we said we were going to build to things that we think we're going to need down the road? I'm going to offer an unrelated comparison to something I've been looking at in the last couple of days. My company works with a lot of pension plans, and many of them made multi-year commitments to non-traditional investments because they wanted to have a balanced portfolio. They had stocks, they had bonds, and then they committed multi-years to real estate pools and other types of investments with a plan of a balanced portfolio. Well, look what happened to the equity piece of their portfolio. They are now reneging on multi-year promises, reneging on contracts that they made to fund alternative investments, because should they continue to make those, they're going to be totally out of balance and breach their fiduciary responsibility to proper asset management within those retirement plans. How is that any different than us looking at prior commitments we made on roads and contracts that no longer apply in a changing world? Maybe we have to do the same type of thing, you know, to say what should tomorrow look like, forgetting about what we thought it looked like yesterday.
Mr. Chairman.
If I might, so taking that pension analogy and expunging things from the portfolio, would that mean expunging segments of road or closing bridges that cannot be afforded to be maintained?
That's exactly what it means. There were bridges that made sense years ago that make sense to some people today, but as we prioritize the entire system, we can't afford to put it back today. That's the Kings Highway Bridge, the Jordan Bridge, and that sort of thing. But that's all over the state. This map that we saw in the earlier presentation, the west of the I-95, I-91 corridor, the number of red dots as to deficient bridges, just numerous. We may not be able to replace half of those. as they become deficient.
Mr.
As
Chairman?
As well as many in Hampton Roads.
Would you like a contrary point of view?
Sure.
I'm absolutely certain that my parents and grandparents, when they announced that we're going to build the interstate system in the United States, they probably thought, we're in the devil's, all that money coming from to build the interstate system. But you know what? Those generations made the sacrifices and built the interstate system for us. I cannot accept the fact that the resources are not there if we have the will and commitment to maintain a high-quality transportation system for Virginia. And that includes roads, transit, mass transit. And if we aren't willing to commit to that, we are, in my opinion, destroying all hope and future for our children and grandchildren. And it just turns my stomach when people have no courage whatsoever to admit that we need to make some sacrifice for the next several years to keep our infrastructure where it needs to be. And it not only includes roads or transportation, I use that word broadly because I think some bridges and roads maybe should be abandoned, but there should be a railroad or some way for people to get where they need to go if we do that. I'm also talking about water and sewer and school construction because it's a sad day in this country when for the last 20 years we have absolutely neglected infrastructure investment, both nationally and in most states. The resources are there. It is just a lack of will on the part of all of us to force it to happen. And without infrastructure investment, we'll never have growth. We'll never have the bright future that we all would hope to have for our children and grandchildren. And I, for one, will not accept the fact that the resources are not there. There's a lack of will.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond to Mr. Chairman?
Absolutely.
There's nothing you've said that I disagree with, except we have no revenue-raising authority. And our duty is to try to manage the system within the resources given to us, and hope is not a strategy. We can look at the last 5 or 6 years, and I think there's a pretty good linear regression as to where we're going. And I think we have a duty to deal with our reality, as valid as your point is, and as much as we can, you know, run with the baton, raise the banner, yell and scream that those in power need to do something differently and it's reprehensible. I made the comment, I think a couple of years ago, after we talked about some of the reports, that I felt like Virginia was a prior Soviet bloc nation. You know, that
developing nation.
Yeah, we were letting our infrastructure crumble around us. Nothing has changed. It's just crumbling faster. But we're not in a position to raise the revenue. We're not in a position to make this change. We can certainly be advocates, but we do have a duty to deal with our reality, and our reality is now changing pretty fast because infrastructure aging, the aging process is occurring faster than our revenue stream is being enhanced.
Mr. Chairman, if I could finish one additional comment, then I'll try to be quiet. I've worried ever since I came on this board about what our proper role is in telling the truth aggressively to members of the General Assembly and the public about what is really needed and what the truth really is on a number of the issues, for instance, that you wrestle with some of those foolish bills that are introduced by, in many cases, people who have very limited interest or very limited knowledge about the topic they introduced legislation. And I have to admit, I was there, and I had to learn a lot about what type of legislation made sense or didn't make sense. And I think every legislator that comes probably faces that kind of a challenge in deciding whether to introduce a bill such as would stand in front of a Mack truck, for instance, trying to eliminate a secretary position. I think we have a role, and it may not be in our legislative mandate, but I personally think this board has to spend a lot more time educating legislators on the truth on a lot of issues about our infrastructure and our need for resources. I've tried to talk to individuals, but I don't think that has the impact that it does of holding public forums for them and laying it out.
because it's really easy, in my opinion, as a legislator, to nitpick and want to reorganize something as opposed to funding it. And that's where we've been the last 20 years. We've been biting around the edges of the way we do things as an excuse for not funding it. And somehow or another, that's got to be brought forth forcibly to both the press and the legislators if we're going to make any headway. That may not be part of our mandate, the way this is created. But I personally feel guilty every time I walk away from here without saying to some people who are making the decisions about our revenues, that's foolhardy to let your infrastructure go down as much as we've let it go down.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to pick up on the education point. I think the Lewiston Road Bridge closure with the 8-mile backup carried on Richmond Television with the legislature in session did more than we've been able to do to reach out and touch them and the public. When incidents occur, it impacts on the public, and legislators listen. They tend not to listen to us because they view us as an appendage of an existing operating political system. But the real key is when the public gets agitated and the public delivers the message that Lewiston Road closure had a profound impact, there was a legislator who did get caught in part of that. We were fortunate in that we did a good job in giving alternative routes. We were able to use Route 1. We were able to use the secondary road and send them off. We had our folks on the media urging people to use alternate routes while the work got done. But it was a good example. I spoke to a group the other day who one of the people raised their hand and said, what are you doing about looking at repairs to our interstate system? They were specifically thinking about the I-95 corridor because they travel it regularly. And their view was they're getting nervous when they cross the bridge. As they said, they think they're going to end up in the train station in Richmond. Their whole focus was on what are we doing looking at redoing that infrastructure. I think part of that is getting those people to let legislators know. And I think that's part of our educational responsibility. I think if we can encourage the public when we have incidents, we need to be proactive and make sure that the message gets out. And quite frankly, for legislators, it's frequently repeat, repeat, repeat. And when they are in session, they are grouped together. There is somewhat of a herd mentality. When they go home, it's much more difficult to reach out and touch them. You have to then do that individually. When you have them grouped together, is the only time that you really can move them in any real direction without the public's assistance. So I think part of our challenge is figuring out a strategy, how to reach out and educate the public, how to go to editorial boards and get them on board, how to effectively utilize the Internet system to deliver the message of the challenges we face, and quite frankly, looking at a failure of political leadership, the assumption of the responsibility to provide sufficient funds. One of the things that folks of my way say is, you know, you don't swallow the apple whole. When you eat it, you nibble on it. Well, that's about what we have to do if we're going to get this job done. It's hard to do billion-dollar projects, but if you lay the groundwork and you do it step by step, you can get those projects done. And I think that's part of the strategy we have to look at. So I think we do have challenges. I think we have responsibilities, and as we downsize, I've talked to several of you, I'm worried that as we come out of this recession, we're going to see an inflationary period. We're going to have the reverse of the budgetary issues we have right now. We're going to wish we had the money to have done projects now because they're not going to be doable because of the inflation rush you're going to see as we come out of this free spending mood we're in at the moment.
I think that's a real challenge for us. So, you know, how do you deliver the message that now is the time we really ought to be able to issue bonds to do projects when costs are lower? I think that's another part of the message. So I don't think we have a whole set of issues that we can look at and address. I think the real question is, how do we educate the public and make them a proactive force to address the leadership in Virginia? I think that's a real challenge.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, there are several interesting thoughts going around the table. One certainly has to do with figuring out what we ought to be doing, what we can or cannot do anymore, whether we should be speaking out about what it costs to do these things, educating legislators and their constituents. One of the fun things you see on television around here, perhaps you all have it where you live, is every morning, every evening, they do traffic reports. And at the end of the traffic report, the thing that a lot of people seem to pay attention to is, and here's where the prices of gasoline are this morning. And on the south side of Richmond, it's $1.61, and over on the west end, it's $1.78, and so on and so forth. My point being that even within one little jurisdiction here in central Virginia, you'll find 15, 20 cent difference in the cost of a gallon of gasoline. And you all heard me say this, but when I've had a lot of fun asking people and legislators, how much did you pay in state gas tax last year? And when you work out what the average Virginian pays, it's 25 cents a day. That's what it costs. And the real people say, wow, is that all? The legislators say, yeah, but I can't raise the gas tax. And I follow, and I say, well, why not? To one fellow who also was complaining to me that we were taking one of his favorite projects out of the six-year plan. And I said, you remember what I asked you about the gas tax? He said, well, I can't raise that. I said, why the heck not? He says, well, I'd have opposition, and, you know, I wouldn't get reelected. Now, there's an honest legislator. Maybe not an admirable position, let's say, for a statesperson to have, but at least he told me the truth, which was, you know, good. But he's not going to raise the gas tax. And yet, I could say, darn it, the price varies from your front door to my door by 15 cents. How could you possibly think anybody's going to notice a 10-cent raise in the gas tax, which I'll grant you is not a long-term solution to our problem, but we need short-term solutions right now. We're going crazy over a stimulus bill that's got 5 cents on the dollar in it for transportation. We need money now to just finish what we've already started. If we never put another new project in the plan, we'd still need 10 cents increase in gas tax or another 15 cents a day for the average driver for the next decade, and that still wouldn't deal with all the bridges that we have to address. Now, that's, I think, a really good story to be telling people, and at least the way I tell it to people, they get it, and they don't seem to be scared at the prospect of paying a little bit more, especially when I say compared to the alternatives, which are either closing down the resource on the one hand or paying tolls. And everybody remembers that guy who came in here from a consulting firm a year and a half or two ago and saying tolls are the most expensive way to do anything in transportation. And those poor people going over the Pocahontas Bridge out here, they're paying more in one day to go back and forth from office to home than they would pay in an increase in the gas tax for a month of commuting. Now, that doesn't make sense to me. Why would you want to pay that much money when you could get away with it for 5% of the cost? And we're not telling that story. Not only do we have to figure out what the state transportation plan is, we ought to be able to figure out how to fund it effectively by taking the least amount of money out of the public's pocket. And I think there are ways to do that we've never really done. And I feel like we owe it to the governor, to the legislature, to the public, to say, you know what? Here's the reality that we face. Here are your alternatives. Here are your choices. Here's what we think needs to be done over the next 5 years, not 2035 but from now until 2013 or 14, wherever we are, and say, you know, and this is what it's going to cost. And here's how we think we can get most of that money by taking the least amount out of your pocket. Now, what do you think about that? And I think, I hope we'll have that conversation. I really do, because nobody else is. Nobody is. And it badly needs to happen.
Thank you. You missed the public hearing in Hampton Roads where the speaker came up, and he actually had stacks of real $1 bills to illustrate that point. And it was a very effective presentation. We promised him an armed guard to get out of the building, but $90 in $1 bills, and then he had it for family. It was very, very effective.
I couldn't agree more with what has been said, Dr. Davis and Jerry and Butch, along the same line, but boy, it sure is a difficult undertaking. Thursday of last week, I was talking to a legislator saying a lot of the same things Jerry just got through saying. Say, you know, that there's been no adjustment in the fuel tax since 1986 while costs have skyrocketed. But the legislature is not doing anything to try to catch up, much less keep it from getting worse. It is getting worse, and they're doing nothing about it. And the quick reaction from that legislator was, well, if I tried to increase gasoline taxes, I'd be defeated for sure. And that's the mindset of the legislature. I think the way, if it can be overcome, is to find a strategy to educate the public, not the legislators themselves. Look what happened to the referenda for the increased taxes in Northern Virginia and in Hampton Roads, soundly defeated. The efforts have been made by the past two administrations, special sessions, and nothing happens. I think the only way in the world we can ever make it happen is to somehow sell the public so that the public, not us, would be pushing the legislators to do what, frankly, is admittedly is very difficult for them to do. But if the public understood what we're talking about, I think they would accept, not only accept, but would urge the legislators to take corrective actions. If we wait until the calamity hits, it's going to be too late.
Mr. Sterling? And then I think after anybody else want to have a comment, because we do want to break, give folks a little bit of time to get ready for the public hearing. So, Court, last word, and we'll pick up this conversation. Obviously, I would say we'll start doing this every month, and this is part of the V-Trans long-range planning process that we'll be discussing every month along with some issue papers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And take off on what some of my colleagues have spoken on across the board, several of the issues. Granted that a statewide referendum for a gas tax failed, but we see, including in my locality, where a referendum for a bond referendum passed by a 14-point margin. Show me the politician that doesn't want a 14-point margin. It passed because people are tired of the problems. They want a solution. It passed because a very viable plan was put before them. We see this in other locations as well. Why not develop a plan, articulate what the cost of that plan will be, and then take it to the public, sell it to the public? The public is the one that's going to have to drive the legislature. We can say all we want. We're not going to be able to do that. But if we put together a plan to fix the transportation system, to replace the bridges, to upgrade the roads, to do everything that needs to be done, not an extravagant plan. We're not talking about gold plating or anything. We're talking about a basic infrastructure that's needed, roads, bridges, rail. Put it together, determine what its cost is, figure out how we would fund that if we had the ability. But sell it to the public on, here's what it is, this is what it'll cost, this is what it equates to. Does it equate to a cup of coffee a day or half a cup of coffee a day? But sell it to the people. The only way we're going to get there is educating them on, here's the vision of what we need to do and where we need to go. Here's what the cost of achieving it is. And really putting that in terms of what it means to them. And then let them be the way, the push, the force.
people aren't afraid to spend money on transportation. They're afraid to have money exit not knowing where it's going. You know, when they hear about you're going to raise a gas tax, they don't know that that's going to go to a road necessarily. It sort of goes into the ether as far as they're concerned. But if you put the plan before them on this is what it is going to achieve, then I think you get a lot more popularity. And just like I said, 14-point margin. Show me the politician anywhere in the state that wouldn't want a 14-point margin.
Okay, last word, Dana.
I agree 100% with what he says, and I would like to encourage us to do exactly that. Now, we several of us have asked the Speaker and Senator Saslaw to put together what I call a reverse conference committee to do a similar plan, not necessarily for this session, understanding that there's not going to be anything that's going to happen this session, but have it ready so that we can work over the summer and build some consensus around a plan, do some educating of the public, show some leadership, step out and say, this is what it's going to take for us to fix the transportation process. I'm with you 100%, and I would love for this group to take on that challenge.
Okay, Alan, you're looking tortured there. Do you want the last word, and then we'll break for dinner?
You know, as a child, we had the Sears catalog in our den, and my mother used to call it the wish book. You know, that's what this thing is that we get all the time. The way we're going to accomplish this is to be serious with ourselves and to tell the citizens of Virginia that with our current level of funding, the book is about this thing. You know, the number of projects in here that will never get done far exceed the number that will. So it first takes the communication of the pain. Where we are now, what we need to tell all these communities, we are not going to do a number of these things. We are only going to complete a few projects, and even the maintenance ones aren't going to get done. And then you start the layers of saying, but if we increase this revenue and that revenue, here's the things we can accomplish. And if we go to this level, here's the things we can accomplish. I think that's the communication that the citizens need to hear to understand what they're going to get for the varying levels of different funding. Right now, they believe that they're going to get everything in the wish book because it's there. Well, they're not. And I think to agree with what you all are saying, we have a duty to repackage this in a way that everyone understands what's reality and what we can do with different alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to close out the work session. We'll break for dinner and be back at 6:30 for the public hearing. Any other questions, comments? We're right out.
So truly, kind of
to the right.